Okay, today we're going to be going through Numbers chapter 10, verse 11, through chapter 12. And this is where the children of Israel finally leave Mount Sinai, where they have been for almost a year, receiving God's instructions. But before we do that, we'll do a brief review from the last time. Last time we covered chapters 8 and 9 of the book of Numbers. In chapter 8, briefly, and this was most likely the 13th day after the tabernacle was set up, the first part of the chapter talks about the arranging of the lampstand in the tabernacle by Aaron, arranged in such a manner that it most likely shone the light on the table of showbread, where the loaves of bread, 12 loaves of bread, were on there representing fellowship between God and Israel. Also, chapter 8 talks about the dedication of the Levites to serve, the actual dedication so that they would be of service in the tabernacle. Chapter 9 is where the children of Israel take the Passover at Sinai. This was on the 14th day of the first month of the second year after coming out of Egypt. And of course, the very, very first Passover was in the land of Egypt, where God gave them the instructions about the Passover, Exodus chapter 12. They took the Passover, and of course, we know the story. This is the Passover they take a year later at Mount Sinai. Also discussed is the institution of the second Passover, or what we call the delayed Passover. If someone missed the ceremony, and that was on the 14th day of the second month, 30 days later from when they had taken the Passover. God instituted this. What was brought to Moses' attention was a couple of the men had touched a dead corpse, making them unclean. They wanted to know what they should do. God's instructions to Moses was that they should take the Passover 30 days later, which we do that if somebody misses the Passover because of sickness or some other type of valid reason. Also, we did cover a little bit more in chapter 10, the first 10 verses. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 10, discusses the silver trumpets. And these were the very last instructions given at Sinai. Silver trumpets were to be made, and Aaron's sons were responsible for the blowing of the trumpets. The reason that the trumpets were to be blown was four reasons, actually, to summon the leaders together, also for the breaking of the camp, to go to war in the land, and also for feasts, beginning of months, and the trumpets were to be blown over sacrifices as well. So that was covered in the first 10 verses of chapter 10, the last instructions at Sinai. Now, as I mentioned, the delayed Passover was the 14th day of the second month. 6 days later, on the 20th day, they're going to be leaving Mount Sinai. And that brings us to Numbers chapter 10, verse 11, where we'll start the Bible study this afternoon. Israel leaves Mount Sinai. Verse number 11. Now it came to pass on the 20th day of the second month, 6 days after that delayed Passover, in the second year, that the cloud was taken up from above the tabernacle of testimony. And that was the signal for them to begin to move out. Verse number 12. And the children of Israel set out from the wilderness of Sinai on their journeys. Then the cloud settled down in the wilderness of Paran. Verse 13. So they started out for the first time according to the command of the Lord by the hand of Moses. Okay, so we see in verse number 11 that the people, of course we've talked about this, had been at Sinai for nearly a year, and also 14 months altogether since leaving Egypt, and nearly 19 days since the census began in chapter 1 and verse number 1, the census or the numbering of the people. The wilderness of Paran, described here in verse number 12, this other scriptures indicate that this was north of Mount Sinai and west of the land of Midian. The New International Commentary adds that Paran was a general term descriptive of most of the wilderness areas of the Sinai Peninsula. We see this phrase in verse number 13, by the hand of Moses. This seems to refer to the blowing of the trumpets to get the camp moving. So the signal of the cloud being taken up was the first signal. Then the trumpets would blow, setting the various camps in order. Remember, there was four groups of three of the children of Israel. And so the trumpet blasts would set them out in order. And we'll talk about that here shortly. Going back to the term wilderness of Paran, here we have in the southern part of Mount Sinai, in this general area, the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula is where Mount Sinai was located. The wilderness of Paran is labeled right here, but it's generally all of this area here in the Sinai Peninsula, from Mount Sinai going up northwards. And that's where the children of Israel are traveling here as they begin their journey. Now we come to verse number 14, moving on. And verses 14 through 27 discusses the tribal organization for the march. Some of this we've already talked about in Numbers chapter 10. Verse 14, the standard of the camp of the children of Judah set out first according to their armies, and over their army was Nashon, the son of Amminadab. Verse number 15 talks about, of course, remember that there were four groups of three. And in this first set is the tribe of Judah in verse number 14, the tribe of Issachar in verse 15, and the children of Zebulun in verse number 16. So the first camp to move out was led by the tribe of Judah and included the tribes of Issachar and Zebulun. Verse 17, then the tabernacle was taken down after this first group of three set out. And the sons of Gershon, who were responsible for the fabric materials and carting them, and the sons of Merari, who were responsible for the wood framing materials, set out carrying the tabernacle. So the tabernacle was taken down, the wood framing and the fabric materials, by the Gershonites and the Merarites. Notice that the Kohathites aren't mentioned yet. They are in charge of the holy items, you know, the lampstand, the table of showbread, etc. So the Gershonites and the Merarite Levites take down the tabernacle, set out after the first group of tribes move out, the first set of three, so that the tabernacle could be erected at the next stop, by the time the Kohathites arrive with the holy items. So we'll see that this is all organized very well in their march. Even though it was such a mass of people, it was organized as they would make their way through the desert. Verse 18, continuing on, the next group of three, and the standard of the camp of Reuben. This was on the south side of the tabernacle. The standard of the camp of Reuben set out according to their armies, and over their army was Elazar, the son of Shedeur. So we see that Reuben is in charge of this particular group. Verse number 19, over the tribe of the children of Simeon, was also in this set of three. Verse number 20, and over the army of the tribe of the children of Gad, was Elizaphath, the son of Deuel. So the second camp to move out was led by the tribe of Reuben and included Simeon and Gad. Then, verse 21, after the second camp moves out, then the Kohathites set out, carrying the holy things. And notice it's in parentheses, and that's not my parentheses, that's in the scriptures themselves. The tabernacle would be prepared for their arrival. So after the second group set out, the Kohathites set out, and when they come to where the camp would stop for the night, the tabernacle's already set up, and they can bring the holy items inside. All very organized. So I've got here on the next frame, after the second tribal camp moved out, the Kohath Levites, followed carrying the sacred items, which included the lampstand, the table of showbread, the altar, and utensils. Now, the ark is not amongst this group that they're carrying, because we're going to see later on, the ark is out in front of all of the tribes leading the way. We'll come to that in verse 33. Okay, now coming to the west side of the tabernacle and that group of three. Verse 22, the standard of the camp of the children of Ephraim set out. And it describes their leader here, Elishama. Verse 23, the tribe of the children of Manasseh with their leader, Gamaliel. Verse 24, and the tribe of the children of Benjamin with Abidan as their leader of that particular, their tribe. So the third camp moved out, led by Ephraim, including the tribes of Manasseh and Benjamin. Finally, the camp on the north side of the tabernacle was the last to move out. That's discussed in verse 25 through 27. The standard of the camp of the children of Dan, again on the north side, the rear guard of all the camps set out according to their armies, and describes their leader. Verse 26, also included was the tribe of the children of Asher. Verse 27, the tribe of the children of Naphtali and their leader. So the fourth camp to move out was led by Dan and included Asher and Naphtali. Notice also verse 28, thus was the order of march of the children of Israel according to their armies when they began their journey. This was the order of their march, and it was an organized march in the way that God had it set up. Now, verses 29 through 32, we're going to read a section where Moses invites his brother-in-law, Hobab, to accompany them on their journey and to scout for them. His brother-in-law, Hobab, which was the brother of his wife, Zipporah. Verse 29. Now, Moses said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, who we read about him in Exodus 18, where he gave Moses advice about setting up elders to help him. He said to Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we are setting out for the place of which the Lord said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will treat you well, for the Lord has promised good things to Israel. So he's selling his brother-in-law on going to the promised land with them and to be their scout. And he said to him, here's his aunt Hobab's answer, I will not go, but I will depart to my own land and to my relatives. But Moses continues to plead in verse 31. So Moses said, please do not leave, inasmuch as you know how we are to camp in the wilderness, and you can be our eyes. Verse 32, and it shall be, if you go with us, indeed it shall be, that whatever good the Lord will do to us, the same we will do to you. So he was pleading with his brother-in-law to scout for them. Now, it's not said what he did, what exactly did happen, but we can conclude that he did go. Moses' father-in-law, Reuel, or Jethro, had given Moses advice concerning organizing Israel back to Exodus chapter 18. Now Moses asks Hobab to scout for Israel because he was a Midianite and he knew the desert areas surrounding Canaan. Now, though it's not stated here in the scriptures, apparently he did accept Moses' invitation to continue with Israel, because in the book of Judges, in chapter 1, verse 16, it shows that his descendants, who are called the Kenites, were in the land of Israel. So apparently he did go along with them, and their descendants settled along with Israel, and they became known as the Kenites. And you can find that in Judges chapter 1. Continuing on, verse 33. So they departed from the mountain of the Lord on a journey of 3 days, finally leaving Mount Sinai. They journeyed for 3 days. And notice, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord went before them for the 3 days' journey to set out, to search out a resting place for them. So the Ark led the way and guided through the them through the wilderness. Of course, God's presence. Verse 34, and the cloud of the Lord was above them by day, and when they went out from the camp. Verse 35, so it was, whenever the ark set out, that Moses said, rise up, O Lord, let your enemies be scattered, and let those who hate you flee before you. Verse 36, and when it rested, he said, return, O Lord, to the many thousands of Israel. Okay, we're talking about a 3-day journey in verse 33. Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary comments that a 3-day journey was about 35 to 45 miles. The all of the Israelites marching with all of their equipment, etc. It adds this journey is reminiscent of Moses' request to Pharaoh to allow the Israelites to journey for 3 days into the wilderness to worship their God. Exodus chapter 8. We see that in verse 33 that the Ark of the Covenant went before them. New International Application Commentary adds this. This indicates that unlike the rest of the tabernacle furniture, the ark precedes the entire column of Israelites. Perhaps the divine cloud that hovers over them, apparently for shade and protection, moves over the ark when it is time to halt. And again, we've got about a 3 days journey so far. That brings us to the end of chapter 10. Now we come to chapter 11. They've made their journey, 3 days. They'd been at Mount Sinai for over a year. And what happens? We find in chapter 11, the people complain. Remember when they first left Egypt? When we come to Exodus chapter 16, hadn't been journeying very long, and they complained. Now here we have it, 3 days journey, and they're complaining again. It's interesting to contemplate that while they were in southern Sinai, where there was not much to sustain them, food and water, they were there for a year, where God maintained them by miracles. And yet, we have no record of them complaining. But as soon as they begin to move, they start complaining. When they left Egypt, get on the road, they complain. Now they leave Mount Sinai, they begin to complain as well. Something about the children of Israel, they did not like to move. But there's also another element to this. The mixed multitude that was among them were the elements behind all of this, as we'll see as we go along. Okay, chapter 11, verse number 1. Now when the people complained, and that word, when you go back to the original Hebrew, means more than just complained. It means that in their hearts they wanted to turn back. Now when the people complained, it displeased the Lord. And apparently this was a lot of complaining. I mean, so much so that God took note of it. For the Lord heard it, and his anger was aroused. So the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some of them, notice, in the outskirts of the camp. Now remember, I gave you charts showing that when the camp was set at night, next to the tabernacle, first of all, was the Levites around them, the closest to the tabernacle. Then the four groups of Israelites were camped around next. Outside of the Israelites was the outskirts of the camp where all the other people were, the mixed multitude that joined the bandwagon to leave Egypt. That's where these people were, on the outskirts of the camp. But again, here they are complaining. God saved them from slavery of Egypt. He sustained them for a year at Mount Sinai. And yet they complain. Okay, continuing on, verse number 2. Then the people cried out to Moses. And when Moses prayed to the Lord, the fire was quenched. So he called the name of the place Taberah, because the fire of the Lord had burned among them. Okay, I mentioned this word complained. The Hebrew terminology is we're as complainers. Companion Bible points out that in this word marks the fact of the people's turning back in their hearts. Let's go back to Egypt. Now the text doesn't give any specific cause for the complaining. You know, water or food or whatever it might be. But God sent fire that consumed the outskirts of the camp. The New International Commentary of the Old Testament adds this. Although this phrase is unique, kasa is used elsewhere to describe an outer boundary, the outskirts that was where the fire went, an outer boundary beyond where the Israelites were camped, in other words. Expositor's commentary adds this: the purging fire was limited to the outskirts of the camp, a mercy of the Lord. Perhaps a burst of fire would not only judge the offenders, but will serve as a symbol of cleansing for the entire camp. You know, the rest of the camp would take note when this took place. Okay, here's another map for you. Down here is Mount Sinai where they left. The 3 days journey, about 40 to 45 miles, Taberah, is located in this area right here. So they marched somewhere from here, about 40, 45 miles, and here's where Taberah was, where the complaining took place in the fire on the outskirts of the camp, just to give you an idea. Continuing on now in verse number 4. Now the mixed multitude, we get a little more information here. Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, "Who will give us meat to eat?" Hadn't they learned where their blessings came from? It makes us shake our head. Okay, so the mixed multitude would have been those living on the outskirts of the camp, where the fire had struck. Mixed multitude comes from the Hebrew, asapsup, which means literally, or Barnes' commentary adds this, means a mob of people scraped together. In the Theological Dictionary of the Old Testament, commenting about this word mixed multitude, says, this masculine collective noun occurs once, only here, in other words, in Numbers 11:4, in reference to the motley collection of people who followed Israel from Egypt. So now we get this sense of where a lot of this trouble is coming from. And again, the mixed multitude, the New International Version translates it rabble. And Expositor again adds this: this term points to a recurring source of complaints and trouble in the camp. And of course, they're complaining about variety. We don't have any meat to eat. We're tired of this old manna that we've been provided with all this time. Okay, we'll go on to more complaining here in verse number 5. Actually, here they're going to reminisce about the good old days in Egypt. Verse number 5. We remember the fish that we ate freely in Egypt. Now notice I got that word freely in bold letters there, bold type. They weren't free. They were slaves in Egypt. We remember the fish we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. Verse 6, but now our whole being is dried up. There's nothing at all except this manna before our eyes. Okay, of course, they're remembering the good old days, but they did not eat freely because the price of the plenty they describe was slavery. They describe in verse 5 the fish, the cucumbers, and the melons. Expositors add to this, the poor in Egypt were able to supplement their diet with fish that are found in many canals and waterways. So fish was actually abundant in Egypt. We may suggest that they were exaggerating, I'd say big time, they were exaggerating the variety and plenty of their diet in Egypt. But the contrast was sure. There are no fish or vegetables to be had in the desert. But here's the main point. The focus of faith, however, is that there should have been no food at all in the desert. That there was anything to eat at all was solely by God's mercy. And they should have been thankful for it. Okay, so they describe all the wonderful things they had in Egypt. Now, as we go along in verse number 7 through 9, we're going to get the positive description of what manna was actually like. Beginning in verse number 7. Now the manna was like coriander seed. This is what they were putting down. And its color like the color of delium. Verse number 8. The people went about and gathered it, ground it on millstones or beat it in the mortar, cooked it in pans, made cakes of it, and its taste was like the taste of pastry prepared with oil. Okay. Verse number 9. And when the dew fell on the camp in the night, the manna fell on it. So we get a positive description in contrast of what they were complaining about. All right, part of the description of verse 7 is coriander seed. was what it was like. Zondervan Bible Backgrounds Commentary gives us more information. The association with coriander seed is like an indicator of its taste. Since that seed is used for flavoring, similar to sesame or poppy seeds. So that tells us what the flavor was like. The color of it was like delium. And delium, according to the theological word book of the Old Testament, was possibly a stone or a pearl or maybe a resin. So possibly like a pearl type color. And a product of the land of Havilah. In the Tanakh Jewish Study Bible adds this. Manna is described here as a rich and tasty food, suitable for various modes of preparation. This positive depiction of manna underscores the unjustified complaints of the people. So actually, it was rich, and it could be used in a variety of ways, and contrasting their blasting it. Okay, we'll continue on now. This complaining that they're doing gets to Moses. Moses, who had gone to Pharaoh to ask for God's, for the freedom for Israel, who was the most powerful man on the planet at the time, one of the most powerful, who had led them through the Red Sea to Mount Sinai, had gone to Mount Sinai, heard God's voice. All this complaining gets to him. We see his human side. Verses 11 and 12. The complaining gets to Moses. He breaks down. And Moses blames God for the situation he's in. Verse number 10. Then Moses heard the people weeping throughout the families. Notice this. Everyone at the door of his tent. They were coming in a procession complaining to Moses one by one. And the anger of the Lord was greatly aroused. Moses also was displeased. Verse 11. So Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you afflicted your servant?" Kind of a woe is me type question. "Why have I not found favor in your sight, that you have laid the burden of all these people on me?" So again, we see Moses, even though he was a powerful individual, a man of faith, he did have his human side as well. Verse 12, another question. "Did I conceive all these people? Did I beget them, that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom, and as a guardian carries his nursing child to the land you swore to their fathers?'" Verse 13, "Where am I going to get meat to give all these people? For they weep all over me, saying, 'Give us meat that we may eat.'" Verse 14, "I'm not able to bear all these people alone, because the burden is too heavy for me." Verse 15, he gets so down on himself. "If you treat me like this, please kill me here and now. If I have found favor in your sight, and do not let me see my wretchedness." So, big time woe is me on Moses' part. And begins to lose his faith as well. From the Understanding Bible Commentary series, it says this. Here Moses complains that the burden of the leading the people is so great that it must be a sign of God's displeasure with him. He says in verse 13 that he cannot meet their needs, especially their crying for meat. And in verse 15, he pleads for his own death. He says in verse 14, "The burden is too heavy for me." Now we're going to, as we move on, we're going to see God's response to Moses. And it's a wonderful response. He doesn't say, "Get away from me, you wicked servant. You know, what are you doing? Are you losing faith in me?" He gives him a wonderful response. He gives him a solution for the burden that he felt. Verse 16. "So the Lord said to Moses, 'Gather me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people and officers over them. Bring them to the tabernacle of meeting, that they may stand there with you.'" That's the solution God had for Moses' burden. 70 elders to help him. Verse 17, "Then I will come down and talk with you there, and I will take some of the spirit that is upon you, and will put that same upon them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, that you may not bear it yourself alone." So God's response to Moses was to select 70 proven elders to help Moses with his burden. and they would be helped by the means of God's Spirit. Okay? Now we're going to have God, that was God's response to Moses. Now as we continue on in verse 18, we're going to have God's response to the people's demand for meat. Verse 18. Then you shall say to the people, get ready, consecrate yourself for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was well with us in Egypt, you said. Therefore the Lord will give you meat, and you shall eat. God is saying, you want meat? I'm going to give it to you. Verse 19, you shall eat not one day, nor 2 days, nor 5 days, nor 10 days, nor 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils, which is a figure of speech that you're going to get sick on it, and becomes loathsome to you, because you have despised the Lord who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, why did we ever come out of Egypt? So we get the true flavor here in verse number 20, the last part of their weeping. They want to go back to Egypt. So this phrase, because you have despised the Lord who is among you, they rejected God, even though they had seen miracle upon miracle upon miracle. The New International Commentary of the Old Testament adds this. Verse 20 makes it clear that God is going to punish the people by giving them what they ask for to excess. Their wish to go back to Egypt was a wish to go back to a time before God was in their midst, and thus a rebellion against him. So it wasn't just wanting meat. It was a rebellion. God says in verse 20, until it comes out of your nostrils. And the Understanding Bible Commentary series says this, apparently refers to severe nausea, which they were going to have from eating so much meat to gluttonous proportions. All right, now we go back in the story to Moses' humanity again, verse number 21. And because Moses starts figuring this out, how are we going to feed 600,000 men on foot with meat, besides all the women and children, etc.? Verse 21, Moses said, the people who I am among are 600,000 men on foot, yet you have said, I will give them meat, that they may eat for a whole month. Again, we're seeing Moses' humanity come out here. Verse 22, shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them, to provide enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them to provide enough for them? And the Lord said to Moses, verse 23, has the Lord's arm been shortened? Now you shall see whether what I say will happen to you or not. Moses, you're going to get proof. Here's a good comment from the Nelson Study Bible. The idea of such plentiful meat in the wilderness was something even Moses balked at, wondering how God could provide food for a company so large. God's response to Moses, has the Lord's arm been shortened, is a challenge to all people of faith. There is simply no limiting the power of God. And, you know, we have those moments, we're human beings, where we have those moments where, you know, oh, woe is me, you know, why am I going through this, or etc. And yet, we've got to keep that faith towards God. Jesus' feeding of the multitudes are a New Testament example of God's continuing ability to provide food for thousands. Okay? Now we're going to jump back in the story to the elders again that were to be at Moses' side. Verse 24. So Moses went out, told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people, placed them around the tabernacle, brought them into the tabernacle courtyard. Verse 25, then the Lord came down in the cloud, spoke to him, and took of the Spirit that was upon him, placed the same upon the 70 elders, and it happened when the Spirit rested upon them, they prophesied, although they never did so again. Okay, this word prophesied means to speak by inspiration. not necessarily prophesying like telling the future, speaking by inspiration, like a minister does, or somebody that teaches by inspiration, etc. Okay, we see, going back to last part of verse 24, that they were placed around the tabernacle. Tyndale adds this, the Spirit was bestowed within the court of the tabernacle in the clean and holy area. And in the middle part of verse 25, the Spirit rested upon them. Nelson's Study Bible, this is a divine empowerment of the 70 elders who would aid Moses in the administration of the camp. And again, this term, verse 25, the last part, they prophesied. Here's a comment from the parallel commentary. Does this mean that the 70 elders received the gift of prophecy as possessed by Daniel or Isaiah? A more reasonable approach is to interpret this as a foretelling event and not that of foretelling. This is to say that these men taught, preached, and exhorted with divine authority. So these elders are going to assist Moses, and they do have help of God's Spirit so that they can teach and preach and help Moses along the way. Now we're going to see this is going to cause trouble amongst people that were close by Moses' side when we get to chapter 12. That there's elders now that are helping out. Okay, I want to go back to the middle part of verse 25 where it says, and God took of the Spirit that was upon him and placed some upon the 70 elders. Sometimes a question comes up about that. How did God do that? Okay. Here's a good explanation from Expositor's Commentary about this phrase, took of the Spirit that was upon him. The taking of some of the Spirit from Moses suggests the release of some of the burden that he bore. They will share in that work with him. Sovereignly, mysteriously, graciously, the Lord apportioned the same Spirit that was on Moses on the 70 elders. The idea is not that the Spirit of God is divided into smaller units, but that it is the very same Spirit of God who empowers Moses that now animates these men. And so God's Spirit is going to be working with them, in other words, like it had been with Moses. But this is, as I said, is going to lead to other issues with ones that are around Moses, specifically family members. We'll get to that in chapter 12. Okay. Verse 26. Here's something. Of the 70 elders, there were two men that weren't in the tabernacle area. Verse 26. But two of the men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, and the other was Medad, and the Spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those listed, but who had not gone out to the tabernacle, yet they prophesied in the camp. So these men were designated to be couple of the elders, but they weren't in the tabernacle area. So verse 27, a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. Verse 28, so Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, one of his choice men, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, forbid them. You know, they shouldn't be doing that. Here's Moses' answer in verse 29. Moses said to him, are you zealous for my sake? And then he adds this, oh, that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his Spirit upon them. So Moses returned to the camp, he and the elders of Israel. So Moses was saying they were designated to receive help in that way, and they got it. And I wish many others were as well, to paraphrase. Here's a good comment from the Nelson Study Bible. For reasons that are not recorded, Eldad and Medad did not join the other elders at the tabernacle meeting. Nonetheless, the Spirit of God came upon them and empowered them in their own camp. When the word came to Moses that these men were prophesying, even though they were not where they were supposed to be, Joshua was afraid that their possible influence in the community would distract from the authority of Moses. Moses responded by wishing that all of God's people or spirit and power. Okay? That kind of ends that section of talking about the elders that would help Moses. Now we go back to where is the meat going to come from that the people are complaining about. Verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near the camp, about a day's journey on this side and about a day's journey on the other side. We're talking about a huge amount of quail all around the camp and about 2 cubits above the surface of the ground. Okay, I think that's something like about 6 feet. 3 feet off the ground, excuse me. Okay, verse 32, continuing on. And the people stayed up all that day, all night, and all the next day, gathered the quail. He who gathered the least gathered 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. Verse 33, but while the meat was still between their teeth, they're gorging themselves, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. Verse 34, so he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. All right, another good comment from the Nelson Study Bible. True to his promise, the Lord provided meat in the form of quail from the sea. He sent a strong wind that brought vast numbers of quail fluttering about 3 feet off the ground. The people fell into a frenzy, killing the birds, gathering them all through the night and on into the next day. And verse 34, we see this place is called Kibroth Hattaavah, which literally means graves of lust. And a huge quantity of dead birds, when we talk about the many thousands of them, would quickly begin to rot in the hot desert. You know, they had all these birds that they were eating, gorging themselves, spread out on the desert floor, soon begin to rot. So the plague was most likely food poisoning that they had gotten. Okay, the final verse in chapter 11 now. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the graves of lust, the people moved to Hazeroth, encamped at Hazeroth. So here's again another map. Here's where they were at Kibroth Hattaavah. Now they move to the north and come to encamp at Hazeroth. And that's where we'll pick up the story now in chapter 12, which is a short chapter. Remember, we talked about the 70 elders to help Moses. This is going to cause problems with family members of Moses. Chapter 12 deals with the rebellion of Miriam and Aaron against Moses' authority. And this is a family trial for Moses. And they start by attacking a wife that he had married. Okay, verse number 1. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman he had married. For he had married an Ethiopian woman. Okay, all this time had gone by now. There's no talk about this marriage, but here they bring this to his attention. This is an excuse. What they're getting at here, this is a smokescreen. The leadership is in question here by Moses and Aaron. And Aaron, excuse me. Of course, Aaron was his spokesman and Miriam was his sister. Okay, it talks about, they're complaining about an Ethiopian woman. There's a lot of speculation on who she was. There's no other record in the scriptures of this woman. The only wife we know of was Zipporah, going back to Exodus chapter 2, where he'd fled to the desert away from Pharaoh, and she was a Midianite. Okay, so there's speculation. Some say that this was Zipporah they were complaining about, and she was a Midianite. Others say that, no, she had died, even though there's no evidence of that, and Moses had married somebody in Egypt and brought her out, possibly a descendant of the Ethiopians. Okay, here's just a couple comments. Here's the one side of it from Tyndale Commentary. Of this Cushite woman, we know nothing except what verse 1 tells us. She may be identical with Zipporah, more usually described as a Midianite, going back to Exodus chapter 2. Habakkuk 3 and some Assyrian texts suggest the identity of Midian and Cush, you know, being interrelated. So Tyndale is saying that this most likely could have been Zipporah. Now here's the other side of it from the introduction to the Old Testament by Harrison. He says this: presumably his first wife Zipporah had died subsequent to being returned by Jethro to Moses, although this fact is nowhere stated in the text. The term Cushite is usually taken as the equivalent of Ethiopian, and as such, the woman concerned may have left Egypt among the Israelites and their followers. And some commentators base this on Josephus, who wrote in the first century, and he writes that Moses married a daughter of an Ethiopian king. So that's where that some speculate that this was. But anyways, there's no record of God criticizing Moses for his marriage. It's Miriam and Aaron that do that. Going back to verse number 1. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses. Tyndale commentary: the text does not explain why Miriam and Aaron objected to this woman, but because in reality, their objections were only a smokescreen for their challenge to Moses' spiritual authority. In the New International Application commentary, Miriam and Aaron are irritated at Moses' non-Israelite wife, but this is only the outer symptom of a deeper grievance. They feel that Moses is unduly dominating their prophetic triumvirate. And as I mentioned, most likely because now there were these 70 elders that were involved in the workings of helping Moses out, they were jealous. And so they attack Moses by this wife. But really, they are jealous and want more power. Verse number 2. So they said, has the Lord indeed only spoken through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also? But notice this: and the Lord heard it. Now this comment is made in verse number 3. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. Okay, here's a comment from Understanding Bible Commentary Series. Moses' sister Miriam, is seen in a leadership role during the departure from Egypt, Exodus 15. It is also traditionally identified as the unnamed older sister who watches over baby Moses floating on the river in Exodus 2. So she was very involved in the history of Israel, of course. They ask this question: has the Lord not also spoken through us? Tyndale commentary: Miriam and Aaron claim that the Lord speaks with them in the same intimate way that he speaks with Moses. Of course, he did not. Speak with is a better rendering of the Hebrew, diberbe, than speak through. So there was animosity between the two of them and Moses, especially with leadership involved. We see this comment in verse number 3 that Moses was very humble in parentheses. This was probably put in by a later editor to put the challenge to Moses' authority in perspective. And one more comment from the Understanding Bible Commentary Series: here it probably indicates Moses' discipline, integrity, and trust in dedication in his relationship with God. The complaints of Miriam and Aaron are contrasted to Moses' qualities. Now God's going to deal with Miriam, who apparently was the ringleader in all of this. Verse number 4. Suddenly the Lord said to Moses and Aaron and Miriam, come out you three to the tabernacle of meeting. So the three came out. Then the Lord came down in the pillar of the cloud, stood in the door of the tabernacle, called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward, probably shaking in their sandals as well. Verse 6, then he said, hear now my words. Is there a prophet among you? I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Verse 7, not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. Verse number 8, I speak with him face to face. That's a figure of speech. Even plainly and not in dark sayings. And face to face is explained in the last part of verse 8. And he sees the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? So, this was put in poetic form, according to Understanding Bible Commentary Series. This speech affirms the validity of prophecy, but the revelation comes in visions and dreams. In contrast, Moses, as God's faithful servant, receives direct and clear revelation. And sometimes a question will come up where it says, I speak to him face to face. We know that no one can look on God's face and live. But again, that's explained in the last part of the verse. He sees the form of the Lord. Tyndale explains further about this phrase, I speak to him face to face. That is not to say he saw God directly and unveiled. The word temuna is used of visual representations, pictures, or images of earthly and heavenly beings. Thus, although Moses enjoyed a much closer relationship with God than any ordinary prophet, he saw only God's form, not the very being of God. He saw the form. Okay, continuing on now, verse number 9. So the anger of the Lord was aroused against them, and he departed. Verse 10. And when the cloud departed from above the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous, white as snow. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and she was a leper. So she was most likely the ringleader in this controversy against Moses. Verse 11, so Aaron said to Moses, when he sees this, O my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned. Aaron came to his senses. Please, verse 12, do not let her be as one dead, whose flesh is half consumed, when he comes out of his mother's womb. So only Miriam is punished, which suggests that she was the primary complainer, going back to verse 1 against Moses. This word, leprous, comes from the Hebrew word sarat, which we have talked about before, which can mean skin disease. Miriam's is the first biblical case of leprosy or skin disease as a divine punishment. And Aaron, of course, Aaron assumed that Moses was angry and pleads with Moses to forgive her and ask for God's healing. And Moses will ask for God to heal her when we come to verse number 13. Verse 13, so Moses cried out to the Lord, saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. Then the Lord said to Moses, if her father had spit in her face, that's a figure of speech, would she not be shamed 7 days? Spitting on the face in ancient times was a show of contempt for another individual. Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterward she may be received again. So he's saying in this figure of speech, if she was spit on her face, she'd have to be ostracized for 7 days. So let's put her out of the camp for 7 days, God is saying. Verse 15, so Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey till Miriam was brought in again. Here's a comment from New International Commentary, Application Commentary. It is ironic that Aaron and Miriam, who were supposed to be prophets, are utterly dependent on the intercession of Moses. You know, they're going along saying, haven't we been inspired to speak along with you? But now they're needing Moses to intervene on their behalf. And another comment from the New International Commentary of the Old Testament, talking about this spitting in the face, figure of speech. If Miriam's father shown some unspecified contempt for her by spitting in her face, she would be held in a public state of humiliation for 7 days. Numbers 5 underlines the holiness of the camp. An unclean person must be put out. And 7 days is what's stressed here. The 7 days can be thought of as a short period of time during which Miriam's leprosy could be cleansed and she could atone for her crime. Now we come to the last verse in chapter 12, verse 16. And the people afterward moved from Hazareth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. Here's a map again. Down here is Hazaroth, where they moved from. And they're going to go to the wilderness of Paran, which is located in this area here. Up here is Kadesh, Barnea, where they're going to be camped when we come to chapter 13. This is where the spies are going to be sent out to go and check out and scout the promised land. So this is where they have come to now. And when we come to chapter 13 is where the spies are going to be sent out to scout the promised land. That's where we end off here in chapter 12. But let's talk about some lessons. After only 3 days' journey, the people complained, which after depending upon God for a year at Sinai, this complaining was a rebellious refusal to trust Him. The lesson for us, instead of focusing on the negative, we can do something positive by taking our problems to God in prayer, in belief that He will hear us and help us. And I've got a reference scripture, Psalm 142, verses 1 through 3, talking about going to God in prayer in our time of need. That's a better formula instead of complaining. Another lesson, Moses, in a show of his humanity, doubted that God could provide meat for a month for the people when they demanded meat. God's response was, "Has the Lord's arm been shortened?" And He sent vast numbers of quail across the camp. The lesson for us, there is no limiting the power of God. It's something that we can learn from this particular story. So that brings us to the end of this particular Bible study.